our brains seem to have two basic capacities, intelligence and imagination. Intelligence operates in a linear fashion. It helps us move logically from fact to fact, from step to step, from number to number. When we use our intelligence effectively, it allows us to live with a great deal of prudential competence. Imagination is another kind of talent. We leap to conclusions. It's untidy. We claim to be able to see beyond the surface of things, within things, what they represent, as opposed to what they physically are. We make connections which have no essential logical relationship between them. Imagination is a capacity which gives us art, poetry, and religion. During the last century or so, the idea developed among Jews that Judaism's supposed superiority over other religions rested on the fact that we do not believe in magic or in miracle workers or in holy men or in faith healing, all the other products of the religious imagination. We don't encourage leaps of faith, and we have no myth. Now, it's true, of course, that learning plays an important role in our tradition. We are taught from the beginning to cultivate the mind. We recognize that the imagination, untrammeled, when it is not retained, can become madness. But it is not true that Judaism has had no truck with faith healing and holy men. As the history of the third of our holy cities of Israel, the history of Sfat, will make abundantly clear. Many of you have been to Sfat and know it is a lovely mountaintop town in northern Israel, an artist colony. Every tourist stops here. The streets are quaint and give off the spirit of a bygone age. This despite the fact that there isn't a building standing in Sfat, which is older than the third decade of the 19th century, when Sfat suffered a terrible earthquake and the city was leveled. We don't know when Sfat was first populated. We know that in Persian and Greek times, it served as a lookout point managed by a small garrison of the conqueror's troops. If you were in Jerusalem and took some faggots and lit them, the fire from this signal could be seen on Mount Tabor, which is the northernmost hill in the Judean range. And then you can light another faggot there and wigwag whatever message you want to convey to Sfat, which is across the valley of Jezreel and which controls the valley's communication systems. Sfat was used as a communication center for armies in the early period of our history. Besides barracks, there was really very little here. And then in the year 1140, the Crusaders, particularly a man named Fulk of Anjou, built a massive mountaintop fortress on the top of the mountain of Sfat. It was one of several mountaintop command centers that were the Crusaders' hopes to ultimately possess the Holy Land. For the next 120 years, the Knights Templars garrisoned Sfat. Until in the year 1260, it was conquered by the Mamluks, who made it a district command center, and a small market town developed. There is nothing in Sfat's early history which suggests the kind of religious history it would enjoy. Jewish history came to Sfat in a rush. We know who traveled to visit Sfat in 1520. He describes a market town. He describes a few hundred Jews who are engaged in farming, small commerce, and the crafts. A small town of no particular intellectual or cultural consequence. But that year, Sfat suddenly became a boom town. It grew from a few hundred Jews in 1520 to 10,000 in 1530. On what did the boom rest? What was its business? It was not a gold rush, but a holiness rush, a rush of piety. Sfat became the Mecca, the focus of pilgrimage of pious, largely Sephardic Jews, came to the Holy Land to do holy acts in order to hasten the coming of the Messiah. Jews had in the previous generation been uprooted from their ancestral homes in Spain and in Portugal, and they were now on the road. And for a certain kind of Jew, Sfat was the only logical goal. But why did these who came to Sfat come there? Sometime during the early Middle Ages, local custom declared that a certain grave 3 miles away near Meron was a grave of a sage by the name of Simeon Bar Yochai. Simeon had been a second century sage who became very much caught up in the Bar Kokhba rebellion, a man who preached that Rome must be overthrown. He became such a pain in the side to the Romans that they put a price on his head. So he had to flee to the wilderness, where he lived in a cave for some say 12 years. During the period in which he was an escapee in the wilderness, legend has it that he engaged in vigils and that during these vigils he had visions. It was believed that in the course of these visions, his soul had gone up into heaven, where he studied with Elijah and the Yeshiva Shalmala and the academy that is on high, and that when he emerged from his 12 years in the cave, he emerged not only with arthritis, but with knowledge of the mystery, knowledge of when the Messiah would come, knowledge of what man must do in order to hasten the coming of the Messiah, knowledge of the secret, deep, inner meanings of the Torah. It was a credulous age. Over time, Simeon Bar Yochai became the patron saint of all Jewish mystics. When you visit his grave, and perform there the vigils, the fasts, and prayers, which were somehow associated with the cult, you might summon Simeon Bar Yochai from the tomb. Or better yet, the prophet Elijah might speak through him and to you. You gain the kind of knowledge of the mysteries which are so essential to the imagination. There's a feature in the architecture of the synagogue of Sfat which is unique. Visitors to Sfat in the 18th century report that in the many very small synagogues of the town, there hung in each of them from the ceiling a long rope with a little basket on the end. In each of the baskets, there was an ostrich egg. What has an ostrich egg to do with the synagogue? Well, if you know your Bible, you know the book of Micah. Micah is made to prophesy the destruction which will precede the coming of the Messiah. Israel will be punished for her sins. And he says, I shall lament and I shall wail mournfully as the ostrich. Micah adds that this wailing and lamentation, the sacred acts which were performed, would precede the Messiah. These, in other words, were not synagogues like ours, where you simply come to study, for prayer, for education, for society. These are places which are part of a whole apparatus of holiness, an apparatus of redemption. In the year 1260, a Spanish Jew, Moses de Leon, inscribed a mystical work which he called the Zohar, and he ascribed it to Simeon Bar Yochai, who had become the patron saint of all the mystics. The Zohar became the Bible of all those who were concerned with the mysteries. Moses de Leon had put together in the Zohar the theological, philosophic, and theosophic basis of mystical speculation. Now, mystical speculation has a noble intellectual tradition. It interested not only ordinary superstitious folk, but almost all of the best trained, most learned Talmudists and sages of the day, practically everyone in the Sephardic world. They knew what philosophy was all about. They thought the philosophy, by which they meant logical faith, the logic which Aristotle had taught, drained religion of all that was religious. Philosophy explained everything. It claimed that God was not a deity who listened to prayer, a creator, a miracle worker, but that he was simply a first cause, a logical postulate, instead of the source of energy and of redemptive power. But there's, of course, another way of looking at the universe, to acknowledge the mystery. And this is how the mystics would have us look at it. The world as we know it is only the outer garment of the real world. Behind the world as we know it and see it is a world of energies, the world of divine, the world of God. If we can understand the makings of that world, we will come to understand our own. So the Messianist ceases to read the Bible simply as text. The Bible as text becomes a shell behind which lies the real meaning of the mystery, the time of the coming of the Messiah, an understanding of the real purposes of various mitzvot. Mystery is an attempt by the imagination to get behind what the intellect tells us religion is all about, in order to maintain that sense of power and energy which religion alone can provide. In the 14th and 15th century, Jews suffered the worst tragedy they would undergo until our own generation. In the 11th century, the Christians began the reconquest of Spain. By the 14th century, they had managed to reconquer most of it by crusade. Crusades were not all against the Holy Land. The largest and most continuous crusade was this crusade to reconquer Spain and Portugal. It lasted 500 years. But then the Arabs were pushed out. Their armies were overwhelmed, and the Arabs who survived were either imprisoned or sold as slaves. The Jewish community was left behind for a while. Jews provided almost all the intellectual, cultural, and medical services that the Iberian society required, and they were part of what was the most powerful Jewish community of the day. But this successful military religious crusade spread a kind of fanatic fervor among Christians, which turned them against any and all other religions with a terrible anger. Little by little, the Christians began to be jealous of the status of the Jew. Was he not the infidel, the pariah, the Christ killer? 1391, at Easter time, there were a terrible series of raids against the Jewish communities of Barcelona, Seville, Toledo, and Madrid. During the 15th century, Jewish life tried to rebuild itself. But during the same period, Christian authority became stronger and stronger. Christians became better educated and were able to take over from the Jews the jobs of the bureaucracy. Jewish life became increasingly tenuous. In 1492, the same year in which Ferdinand and Isabella were married, the heir was therefore brought together the kingdoms of Aragon and Castile into a single state, the last Arab stronghold in Spain, a stronghold near Gibraltar, fell. To celebrate that reconquest, the court passed an edict that all Jews who did not convert were to be exiled from Spain and that this was to be carried out within 6 months. The rich and the powerful and many of the learned chose conversion. They were unwilling to leave their possessions and their life behind. Most ordinary Jews and a few of the rich and the powerful took to exile and went to Portugal across the mountains. But that proved only a temporary place of refuge. Portugal itself passed a rule of expulsion and of exile 6 years later. As a result of these two acts, 500,000 Jews found themselves adrift on the roads of Europe and North Africa. Where did they go? The Low Countries had not yet become Protestant. Italy, largely controlled by the papacy, had been a fairly quiet place. But now the Counter-Reformation was in full swing. The church was afraid of what Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin, the reformers, were doing in Northern Europe. And so the popes began to impose restrictions on Jewish communities who were a source of potential heretical ideas. The only place that Jews could hope to settle with any chance of starting life anew was in the East. The Turks had recently conquered Constantinople and were eager for Jewish skills, culture, literacy, and capital. So in Constantinople, Salonika, and Izmir, all up and down the Turkish coast, you found groups of new Jewish settlers. Another kind of refugee also came to Turkey. Scholars, people trained in the Jewish mystical tradition, men who saw that Israel had been exiled not only from its own land, but from Christian lands. Tragedy had been piled upon tragedy, yet these men felt deeply within their bones that the time of the Messiah was drawing near. Why so? In our tradition, descriptions of redemption assume that the world will become a terribly difficult place before it gets better. There will be trouble, travail and turmoil of all kinds before the great day dawns. The Talmud uses a homely image, the birth pangs of the Messiah. The birth pangs seem to be everywhere, all about. In 1492, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. In 1498, the mass deportation from Portugal. The early 1500s, the papacy began to make it difficult for Jews to remain in the Papal States. In 1521, Venice established the first ghetto. Everywhere you turn, you could feel the birth pangs of the Messiah. Now, there were those who simply expected the divine drama to begin and to run its own course. But there were also those who believed that Jews themselves had a role in the divine drama. Jews who would go to the Holy Land, to a holy place, to perform holy acts and hasten the coming that they so desperately wished for. Their work would be critical and as significant, as important to Jewish life as that of anyone who established a more traditional kind of community or city. Safa became a center for those who mourned Zion and performed in their daily lives the ritual acts which it was believed would hasten the coming of the Messiah. Safa became a kind of permanent revivalist camp. The greatest of the Kabbalists of the 16th century, Isaac Luria, settled in Sfat. It was a place to which men in which men regularly had visions. It was a place in which people talked a great deal about the transmigration of the soul. There was a doctrine popular in Sfat, Kibbutz HaKvir, which assumes that the dead can talk with certain mystics, that these mystics will learn from those dead the mysteries that they have learned when they passed into the grave. It was a time when rabbis, holy men, could exercise the dibuk, evil spirits. There was a feeling that those who were charismatic, holy men, had secret knowledge. And if you gained that knowledge, you gained peace of mind for yourself, and the secret of entering heaven upon your demise. At this time, by the way, the custom developed that you should recite the Kaddish for the benefit of your dead. The Kaddish was an old prayer, 1,000 years old, which had long been associated with the glorification of God and gratitude for God's life. It had been customarily spoken in the yeshivot, the end of the period of study of rabbinic law or lore. The Kaddish began to be recited in order to guarantee that your loved one would enter heaven. It became the duty of every Jew to speak the Kaddish for his immediate relatives for 11 months, and then on the anniversary of their deaths each year. Why 11 months? Because you didn't want your dead to feel that they need a full year of your intercession to get into heaven. The mystic of Sfat would get up in the middle of the night and have night vigils in the synagogue, where they stand and study and pray all night long until the visions came. It was a time of public confessions and of flagellations. Whole series of regulations were published governing what must be done by those who lived in Sfat. If you had committed a sin, however minor, say you had maliciously gossiped, you not only had to beg your victim's pardon and their forgiveness, but you had to fast 2 days a week for 2 years. And every time you passed the one whom you had gossiped about on the street, during those 2 years, you had to bow yourself before them, offer yourself to be beaten by them, and ask public forgiveness of them. At the beginning of this 2-year period and its end, you had to appear in the synagogue, there to be beaten with 39 stripes in order to admit your guilt. In other words, it was a community of intensely religious people who went far beyond the norms of Jewish law. It was a bizarre, intense, fervent, parochial, and mysterious world. If you read about the Salem witch trials in the early 18th century in the United States, you can imagine something of Sfat. There were no trials or executions of Sfat, but there were exorcisms. There was a conviction that an evil soul would enter somebody's body and had to be bought out. There was a belief that charismatic, holy men had secret knowledge. If you gained that knowledge, you would gain peace of mind for yourself and the secret of entering heaven. The best way to suggest to you some of the feel of that world, to tell you of the most important mystic who lived in Sfat, a man named Isaac Luria. Luria was born in the 1530s in Jerusalem. His father died when he was very young, 6 or 7. His mother took the family to Egypt, where a brother was a rich merchant. And there, Isaac Luria studied Talmud, commerce, and business with his uncle. There he married, and he raised a family. He remained in business. As a matter of fact, the only handwritten document we have from Luria is a bill of sale for an order of pepper, which he was to deliver to merchants who were on their way to Baghdad. When you wonder, and I certainly do, how the madness of a Khomeini and the madness of the cult people is associated with also with a certain kind of practicality, how they remain able to live what we would consider otherwise normal lives. Think of these Sfat mystics. Luria was a fine Talmudist. He was a great scholar. His inner life, his real life, was one of visions. During his early education, he came across a copy of the Zohar. It fascinated him. He went to teachers and he learned what he could from them. Then he went off to his own Walden Pond, to an island in the middle of the Nile near Cairo, which his uncle owned. And he lived there for 8 years by himself. Except, unlike Thoreau, he went back to his wife and to his home on the Sabbath. He continued as a father and in business. It seemed perfectly natural for him to spend 6 days a week on this island, studying, meditating, and fasting. He felt his soul rising ultimately to heaven. He felt he had been allowed to participate in the great academy on high, to learn something of the mysteries. After 6 years of vigil, Luria left Egypt for Sfat. The charisma of this man, the sense of holiness which surrounded him, quickly made him a center of a circle of the pious of the city of the pious. They would go out together to visit the graves. Apparently, Luria claimed, and his disciples supported him in this, they could speak with the dead. He would go out to the grave of Simeon bar Yochai, and there great mysteries took place, and much was revealed that had not been known before. When he spent all night in the synagogue, people would come to him, and he would be able to see what their problem was. He would see what a soul possessed and was able to exorcise any evil spirits. He said that he himself was a reincarnation of Simeon bar Yochai. He looked upon himself as a forerunner of the Messiah. Now, Luria lived only a year and a half in Sfat before he was taken off at 38 by one of those plagues which periodically swept through the medieval world. Dying young is very important to the legend of a faith. It defines his credibility. It proves that God wanted to take back early one of his own. And why did these people think they could, what did these people think they could do to hasten the coming of the Messiah? According to Luria, when the world had been created, a big bang had taken place. It had been of such intensity, some of the divine light had spilled out of the circles of heaven, which were designed as its container, and got lost in space. In space, this overflow of God had been surrounded by material, which was hard as shells. The reason that redemption did not come was that God was thereby diminished. The diminished God was not powerful enough to bring redemption about. How could God be put back together again? Who could break the shells? Only the prayers of the Jews, the prayers specifically of their holy men. The Bible and the Torah were not simply what they seemed, language, history. They contained the revelation of the mystery. The mystery of the nature of the universe. It told how man could restore the world, put the world back into shape by concentrating on tikkun olam, by bringing God back to God, the lost light to the supreme light. The mystics would strengthen God, and ultimately God would bring about redemption. So essentially, these holy men and the Jewish people were the agents of salvation. It was a handy doctrine for a dispossessed and dispersed people who just suffered the worst tragedy in their history. People in comparison with the great powers of the world were of little or no account. In this thesis, they became the central actors in the drama of redemption. Nothing can happen redemptively unless Jewish holy men make it happen. For the next 200 or 300 years, Jews found in this mystical ideas dignity, a sense of power and of purpose. No rational system, no philosophy could have provided this. People cannot live without a sense of purpose. If there is no meaning given to us in the outside world, we must find meaning in the world of the imagination. The imagination provides the content. And Tzfat was the place where imagination worked out a mystical scheme which allowed Jews to survive with some dignity until the 19th century and the emancipation. Now, I will not defend the thesis that Tzfat's teachers and teachings are reasonable. They certainly would not be reasonable for us. Yet I wonder if there is not something to be learned from Tzfat, that strange medieval community which is immediately relevant to our lives. Obviously, many today perceive the times to be tragic. People have espoused an interest in mysticism and astrology. Even people who do not see the times as tragic no longer feel themselves in control of their lives. Obviously, they are turning more and more to the imagination and less to intelligence. You can see that in the music of our times, in the poetry of our times, and in the literature of our times. It's not so long ago that we had a whole spate of books which claimed that it was our intelligence which was misleading us and urging us to listen to the imagination and to our feelings, to be genuine. Remember the Greening of America and books of that kind. But before we join the parade to the imagination, let's be careful of the consequences of too ready and too complete a plunge into it. Imagination and intelligence are separate capacities, separate but not equal. Intelligence remains the primary survival category. Tzfat had a brief history of as a holy town. It retains mementos of that history now, but it is gone. The imagination, that world is finished, while the world of Judaism, the world of the intelligence, remains and is strong. Amen.